Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Insider, brought to you, just for a change, by the delightful people at Vanishing Ink. My guest today is an Olivia Award-winning writer for stage. He's the creator of Hector Chadwick and an all-round delightful chap. It's Stephen Long. Stephen, how are you this evening?
I'm very well, thank you. And it's very kind of you to say such things.
What's your magic origin story? You've got 19 seconds.
That's not long, is it? I feel like I could use up the time simply by commenting how little time I have to use up. But my earliest memory, I suppose, is buying little tricks. They were called abracadubris. I don't know if this will mean anything to anyone else, but they were sold in my local toy shop. I used to save up my pocket money and then go and buy them. They were things like little packet tricks and kind of the flick the wood through the pin illusion thing. I don't know if you're familiar with that, or you can picture it, the sort of the stick flips around so fast it looks like it just passes through. So I used to buy those. I also used to buy what I later recognised were tenyo tricks, and I had a copy of the Crystal Cleaver, which is one of my favourite tricks. You can look it up if you're interested. Anyway, then lost it, very sad, and now don't own it anymore. But then, got very interested at a very young age, then forgot about it. Then I got a bit older, I was about 16, and Blaine was very popular at the time. And my big brother showed me the invisible deck, which Blaine had done on his street magic specials.
Performed it or explained it?
He just showed it to me and without explaining it, and it blew me away. And I didn't understand how he suddenly had these powers. And that was the point at which I started to get heavily interested in it again. I suppose that was the beginning for me.
That's a good beginning. How many Svengali decks did you sell in Thorpe Park?
I mean, we lost count in the end. So for people who won't know what that question is about, it's how actually I met my wonderful friend and writing partner, Ian Sharkey. We used to sell Svengali decks and sponge balls and ESP canisters and other little tricks to people at a popular amusement park in the UK known as Thorpe Park, where you can go on roller coasters and stuff. And there's an area, there's a sort of a domed area that everyone has to walk through to enter the park. And we were set up in the middle at this little four-sided, kind of quite tatty magic bar, green-based magic bar, and people would come up and, you know, say, what's all this about? Then we would show them tricks and try and sell them. And nothing good came from that. We did it for very little money. But I say nothing good came from that. The only good that came from that is I met Sharky and wouldn't have a career if I hadn't met him. So,
well, that's a pretty good thing to come from it. You've changed your tune on a sixpence. I've mixed my
I know. Well, I'm a mercurial fellow, I suppose.
how did you first get involved with, for people, I didn't mention it in the intro, but you have helped and written for Derren Brown for some time. So how did you first get involved in working with him?
That's one of those things which is really just luck. I can't lay claim to being, you know, good enough to have worked for him without my share of luck. But I met him before he was quite as well known as he is now. He was just kind of ascending in his rise to stardom, I suppose.
So this is post Bristol, and as he'd started the TV stuff?
It was the very first live tour, which was called Derren Brown Live. And so Mind Control had already aired. And Pure Effect and Absolute Magic were out, I think, at this point. And I'd emailed him to ask for some advice, actually, sort of as one magician to another. Like, oh, well, you know, I want to make a living doing this stuff. Can you, you know, what can you tell me that will make me rich? And he replied. So he still had a manager at that time, but I guess enough emails made their way through that he might, you know, at that point in his career, still read them and take time to reply to them. And anyway, he was very lovely, and he took the time to reply, and he wrote this wonderful, thoughtful and considered email about sort of magic and magic related stuff. And that was that for a little bit. But then I went to university in Wales at Aberystwyth, and his live tour, Derren Brown Live, brought him to Aberystwyth. And so I emailed him and said, oh, you know, like, just on the off chance, not expecting this to happen at all, but just on the off chance, you're coming to my uni. I've got tickets to see you. Like, I had front row seats because I was a huge fan. And I said, I don't suppose there's any chance that, you know, I could meet up and get my book signed, I think is sort of all I wanted. And gracious as he is, he said, absolutely, why don't you, you know, pop back and say hello after the show. And so I did, took a few friends back, and we all went to his dressing room and said hello. And that was the first time I met him. He signed my books. And then later it transpired that... So then I met Sharky, who I've referred to earlier, my now writing partner. And it's sort of interesting. I can't remember which one of us dropped it first, but we were both sort of humble bragged that we knew Darren. One of us said to the other, oh, actually I happen to know Darren a little bit. And the other person said, so do I, which is a very, very coincidental and odd thing to have happened, for two magicians to meet and both know Darren independently. So that we both knew him meant that I think we sort of hung out and went for dinner a bit as the three of us. And then that was the beginning of it. And then I got just as I was finishing university, I did a degree in drama. And weirdly, as fate and Dame Fortuna would have it, Darren needed an assistant stage manager on his live show, which was then Something Wicked This Way Comes. And ideally someone with a little bit of magic knowledge, mm-hmm. and someone with a bit of a background in theatre. So I was very into magic and I'd just finished a degree in theatre. And so my last day at university was the day before my first day going to the West End to work on... as an ASM on Something Wicked This Way Comes. So I packed up my life in Wales. I think my parents came to collect me. We drove all the way back, and the very next day got on a train to London to learn what my role was in this stage show.
So everybody else from the degree course is going to work in McDonald's or whatever, and you're actually going to the West End to ASM for a show.
I hadn't actually quite considered it in those terms. But yes, they're probably a lot of my fellow... alumni would probably be furious with me.
Yeah,
it worked out all right, actually.
So I'll say. But so, okay, so how do you go then from ASMing to writing for him?
It was, it was a, it wasn't sort of a smooth process. So Sharky kind of started writing for Darren fairly immediately after the two of them met, and I took a little longer to kind of help out with the writing process, and that's because I'm not, I wasn't very good at it.
Right.
So very early days, I remember being invited because, you know, Darren would get the occasional consultant in to help out with, you know, Trick of the Mind or whatever kind of TV series was running at the time. Because, you know, he knew me, he knew I was a magician. He got me in for a day to work with him and Andy Nyman to help come up with ideas for what I think might have then been Trick or Treat. And it was a disaster. It was terrible. First of all, you know, how intimidating in the first place to kind of,
for sure,
you know, be in a room with these two giants. And they had this one particular problem they couldn't quite crack. And they sort of brought me in to see if I could help them with it. And I couldn't. Didn't know what I was doing. So then, you know, wasn't invited back, understandably, for quite some time. But nevertheless, I was at some point invited back. I think, so this is when they were writing Svengali. And I just kind of came a bit more prepared. I had some thoughts beforehand. And over the years, I've learnt how to... Because the problem is, you know, when you're in a room with people like Darren and Andy Nyman, like, you censor yourself, you filter yourself. You're like, well, I won't say this because maybe it'll sound stupid. Maybe that's a ridiculous idea. But of course, the only way you can generate ideas is to remove those filters and to, you know, give yourself permission to speak freely.
And fail.
And so I think, and exactly, yes. And so I think that I had perhaps learned to do that a little better by the mm-hmm. time I got another chance to be in a room. So yeah, they needed some ideas for Svengali, one of the live shows. And I came in for what, initially, it was just going to be a day, I think, and then became 2 days, and then became a week, and then ended up co-writing Svengali, which is incredible and one of the things I'm proudest of. And then after that, started coming in to help out a little bit more with the TV stuff, and then I've since been lucky enough to help co-write some Derren TV shows, which is incredible, really. And I don't... every time I stop to remember that I've done that, I find it kind of extraordinary. But so that's sort of how it all happened, I guess.
What's the process like for writing one of the shows? Is there always the same starting point? Do you write collectively or have time apart to come up with ideas? What's the process?
It needs a hook. First of all, it needs a big kind of, oh, wouldn't it be interesting if ... So for Apocalypse, you know, it was, oh, wouldn't it be interesting if, you know, we created a zombie apocalypse for someone. I could very rarely take credit for any of those kind of headline ideas because I don't naturally come up with those big ideas. That's very often Derren and Sharky and stuff. And my role tends to be in refining them a little more once we have the rough concept. But in any case, yeah. So once you have the big idea, it's working backwards from that and then forwards from the beginning, which is, you know, you have the big idea, and then it's a case of, well, you know, why would you do that? What would that look like? What would be the point? You know, because the Derren shows, although they started off being, it didn't matter so much in the early days if they were just kind of these fun, outrageous, almost practical jokes. Mm. But later, you know, as Derren himself kind of, you know, matured a little bit, I suppose, in what he wanted to do, they started to have more of a heart, more of a philosophical heart, more of a meaning and purpose. And so, obviously, it's important to figure that out. And Derren often talks around that quite a lot himself, you know, in the room. He'll have been reading something or he'll have this idea that he wants to explore. And so then it becomes this process of kind of melding this outrageous, what if someone pushed a guy off a roof, with a kind of a philosophical heart that we want to kind of, merge it with. And yeah, and so you work backwards from the headline and then forwards to kind of try and fill in the blanks. And by the end of it, hopefully you have. And then, of course, you know, you have to worry about the practicalities of, yes, but can we actually do it? You know, a couple of times over the years, we've had this sort of headline idea that initially felt like it might be a joke. And then we stopped to go, well, hang on, could we actually do that, though? And it turns out that maybe we could actually do that. So, yeah. So then it's always about finding that, as I suppose it is in kind of a lot of creative endeavours, and certainly with designing illusions and stuff, is that marriage between what your dream vision for the thing is and the practical constraints of, you know, what you can actually do. So once it's been through that machine and all those aspects have been considered and worked out, then you end up with a show of some description. So I guess that kind of tends to be roughly how it goes.
That there Vanishing Ink, who I mentioned, who are bringing this podcast to the ears and eyes of everybody watching and listening, are about to do what I believe is the third printing of your book, The Mental Mysteries of Hector Chadwick. Now, when it was a ring-bound, self-published release, I imagine you never dreamed of such a day. How does it make you feel now?
Staple-bound, Damien. Do your research.
Oh, I'm so apologise. I do apologise. My research is getting fired.
I dreamed of it being a spiral-bound publication.
One day, if I work really hard, I may even get that laminated plastic.
It's wonderful. It's a wonderful, wonderful feeling. It's been sort of very kind to me, that little book, and it's been on a wonderful journey as well. I've got most of the editions behind me, but yeah. So from a little kind of sort of basically just stack of papers to the first printing, which was just 100 black editions, and they're out there somewhere in the world. And then I printed not many in this sort of white hardback, and then I did a third printing of the brown ones, and I think I did the most of those. And then I kind of put it to bed for a long time because basically I wasn't sure if I liked it anymore. I think that there's a certain type of creative person, isn't there, which I think is most creative people, who when they've done a thing, or when they're in the process of creating it, they'll be like, I just don't know if that's any good. Maybe I'll just forget about that and never do it again. And so I certainly struggled with that a little bit. And So yeah, so I wrote it when I was very young, and you know, when you're young and you have kind of, you have the confidence and the ignorance to presume that you have something worthwhile to offer the world. And then I got a little bit older and started second guessing myself and thinking, oh, no, maybe it's all terrible. But then, and actually I talk about this a little bit in the revised introduction to the book, all this stuff, but I started to kind of get, after a hiatus with magic, I started getting kind of pulled back into it. And I started meeting up with people and making new friends who would sort of reference ideas from the book and say, that's really great. I use that in my work. And I heard stories of other people who were using ideas and stuff. And I sort of had this, a little kind of penny drop moment almost of, oh, like maybe people actually seem to value it. And maybe it is good. And so I went back to it. And so there were aspects of it that I wasn't kind of entirely happy with, but I just rewrote them and added some new ideas. And to have it, I mean, I have my copy behind me. Can I get it? For people that are watching on the video, they'll be able to see it. And so to have it as this kind of beautifully produced, you know, vanishing ink book is lovely. Sometimes I just pick it up and I run my fingers over the embossed cloth, just get a little kick out of it, and then I put it back down again.
Quite much. For people that are unfamiliar with the book, what kind of material is contained within its hallowed pages?
I didn't know the pages were hallowed, but I'm delighted to be informed that they are. It's a mentalism book. So it's called The Mental Mysteries of Hector Chadwick. So it's mentalism. It has some kind of, you know, cards, a couple of card things in it too that I think would be of interest to card magicians. And it has, I think it's something like maybe five or six of each in terms of routines that you can do on stage, a kind of stage focused, and routines that you could do close up. And all the close up stuff is pretty impromptu, a couple of impromptu mentalism-y card tricks, a couple of equivoke routines, which is a subject that I have thought a lot about. And the stage stuff has got things like, I've always been interested in open predictions, the idea of showing the audience something that then the person on stage will then do, having not seen the prediction themselves. So there's an open prediction routine. There's also a psychometry routine with people's sets of keys, where you're able to describe a set of keys that you haven't, that have been hitherto, shall we say, unseen. So, yeah, and then some essays, which I know people kind of like, oh, boring, just give us the tricks.
Give us the trick, mate.
But, you know, one of the essays is only a sentence long, so maybe that's a selling point, I don't know.
I think that has to be the shortest essay in any magic book. You mentioned equivoque. What's the trouble with it? What's the trouble with equivoque?
The trouble with equivoque, I mean, it's so sort of problematic, isn't it? Because everything that you do with it is just out. It's just out in the open for everyone to see. And in a lot of areas of magic, of course, that doesn't matter. I can show someone a double lift, and the point is that you're looking right at it. Mm. But with equivoque, all the evidence, if somebody was minded to kind of deconstruct it, certainly if someone, you know, filmed a video of like a worst case scenario equivoque routine, they could just go away and deconstruct it. All the clues are there. And, you know, we do things like, we use things like, we'll split the sentence, pick up any one of those and hand it to me or whatever. And the issue is that decisions are being made first and defined second. That's right. Every step of the equivoque process. Someone makes a decision, the performer decides what that means. Someone makes a decision, performer decides what that means. And so anytime you call attention to that, like pick up one of those and hand it to me, you're calling attention to the method. So so there's a lot of pitfalls, a lot of things that can go wrong with it, and very often, you know, there's a danger that it's just kind of painfully transparent. And I think that a lot of us kind of will use it once and then just kind of carry on and, you know, really... Hang on, sorry, did you mean... When you said pick up one of those objects, did you... Because I thought you actually meant that I was going to be choosing that, for, you know. So we're relieved that didn't happen and on we go with the trick. Although maybe people are thinking it a lot of the time. So, yeah, so I over the years, I sort of took it upon myself to see if I could find what the best stuff was out there. And I did a lot of reading around and I never found anything that I was like, oh, wow, you know, like, this is it. This is the answer. And so I kind of did a lot of thinking around it myself and broke it down into kind of its component parts and thought about when it's at its most deceptive and when it's at its least deceptive. And so in one of the routines in the book, I got to the point where you can ask the question, which do you want to keep? Because I was like, I sort of almost set that as a challenge for myself. How concrete can you make the language? How solid can it be made? And then, you know, in the next phase is which one do you want to get rid of? And you can genuinely ask those questions and continue the routine seamlessly, no matter what the answers are. And so in one of the routines in the book, I got to the point where you can ask the question, which do you want to keep?
Why did you use a pseudonym and why is it Hector Chadwick? Where did that come from?
I used a pseudonym because I sort of thought it would be more fun, really, I think was the is the very basic answer. This is a very difficult question for me to answer because I have absolutely no sense of having any kind of a name for myself anyway, under my real name. And certainly back then, when I first released it, I thought there's no way anybody, you know, knows who I am. Even though there was no reason they should, I kind of had I sort of knew Darren a bit and that was kind of it. But I thought rather than... release it under a name that people can Google and say, oh, yeah, some guy that's... I thought, oh, he's worked with Darren a bit, maybe. I thought it would be more fun to release it under a name that's just sort of not Googleable, that nobody can find anything out about. And it just struck me as a kind of a more interesting and fun approach. Although, you know, I don't think... some magicians didn't like that, I don't think. Thought I owed it to people to announce who I was. The name itself came from... I don't know how interesting this is, but nevertheless, one of my housemates at university had a picture on their wall, which was just paint splodges, and it was done by her niece, I think. No, wait, nephew. I always get those two mixed up.
Well, gender fluidity is a thing now, so that's fine.
Nobody minds. And underneath it said, the painting was terrible, you know, because it's done by children. Children are terrible at painting. They don't care what any parent says. Your children cannot paint. And underneath it said, by Hector Chadwick. And I said, oh, that's a very cool name. And she said, oh, yeah, that's my nephew. And for some reason, I just never forgot it. That name always stuck with me. And so I don't really know why, but when I put the book out, I just sort of thought, well, we'll use that name.
So I wonder if the real Hector Chadwick is Googling himself and finding all these references to your book and getting very annoyed about it.
I hadn't considered that until this moment, but I...
Maybe you've scarred him.
It's fun to imagine that he is out there somewhere, just at the very least, vaguely bemused.
Yeah. Surely I'm the only Hector Chadwick. No, somebody's written a book. Looking back at the book, what do you think is the single most useful or important piece of information in it?
Oh, my goodness. It's a terrible question to ask someone like me because I struggle to... say with confidence that I have anything worthwhile to offer the world. I mean...
Okay, I'll rephrase the question. What's something that other people have told you?
All right, fine. Also, that came out a little harsher than I... than the concept was in
my head.
Don't
ask me to say I'm good. No.
I'm not thinking of ending things or anything like that.
Do you need a hug?
I do, but alas, social distancing measures prevent that kind of behaviour. But I suppose it is the Equivoke stuff. In terms of, I feel like there's some good ideas in the book, and I actually my favourite pieces of writing are the essays, which I imagine that will, I mean, the right kind of reader will I think really enjoy those and hopefully get something out of them. Your average magician will probably be more interested in the tricks, which is fine. That would be me as well if I was a reader. But I think that I think for me it probably does come back to the Equivoke stuff.
Okay.
And in helping to kind of form that a little more. And in particular, there's a section called The Equivocal Miscellany, which is a piece of writing about just stuff you can apply to any equivoke routine, little ideas. There are just a few paragraphs each that will just help make it stronger. And I think that, and I don't think that that has been offered to the magic world in that kind of form and broken down in that way before. And so in that sense, though I hope the tricks are good and though I hope the essays have something worthwhile, I think that there is stuff in the Equivoke section that feels like it hasn't been properly explored yet, or at least not to my knowledge. I'm sure there's some brilliant thinkers out there that have done similar work, but yeah, I hope that is the thing that people get the most from.
Okay. I'm about to reference a British television show. So for American or rest of the world listeners, there was a show called Room 101, referencing Orwell, where you could put things that you hate.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very popular television show in England, and now I'm going to reference it. If you could put one thing from the world of mentalism into Room 101, what would it be?
Oh, interesting. So, oh God, I think I want to say solemnity, which I don't know if that's quite the right word, but my feeling generally in the world of mentalism, and I think this probably is just a matter of taste.
Sure.
But my feeling in the world of mentalism is that, and I really don't think it's changed much over the years, is that there's a lot of dark suits and a lot of pressing of temples and a lot of, you know, mysterious envelopes and then a lot of gravitas and a lot of sort of earnestness. And I would love to see it feel, well, I think, you know, I feel like I've said the word fun too much on this in this discussion, but I would love for it to feel more fun. And I would love to feel like, I would love to feel like more performers that are happy and have the confidence to present themselves as, you know, I suppose, and I think this is Darren's thing a little bit, but I suppose as a bit more human and a bit more kind of, you know, a genuine side of themselves rather than what you feel is kind of often a front of you know, some performer who has this incredible mind. It's not necessary. And I think that it could be more interesting from performers who are happy to explore that side of themselves a little bit more. And that's not to say that I don't enjoy performers who are that. You know, I there are performances I see who are very much that, and I think they're wonderful and brilliant. In general, I think that, yeah, people could have more fun with it, probably.
What are three things that you're most proud of?
I was a very good waiter when I worked at the Harvester in Old Windsor.
Have you been to a Harvester before?
If not, then I'll show you the salad. Is that
what you're about? That's good, yeah, that's good.
That always stumped people entering the restaurants. I mean, this would be entirely lost on your foreign listeners, but the Harvester is a chain of restaurants in the UK where when you enter, you get asked by whoever's seating you, have you been to a Harvester before? And the emphasis very often falls on the bin as well. Have you been to a Harvester before? And it really stumps people because, you know, it sort of short circuits you. Yes? No? What's the correct answer to this question? The reason they ask it is so you know all about our salad bar, because the salad bar is complimentary with any main meal. So definitely that, because Yeah, I earned good tips, and I was good at my job. One of the few things in my life I can look back on and say with confidence, I did that well.
Okay, there's one thing that you're happy to say you're good at. Waiting in harvest. Okay, that's one. Got two more, please.
So that's one thing. The second thing is probably The Great Art Robbery, which I co-wrote with Darren Sharkey. And I feel like of all the Darren shows that I've worked on, maybe kind of alongside Svengali, but of all the Darren shows I've worked on, that I feel like I had the most, I don't know if influence is kind of too sort of pretentious a term, but that I feel like I had the most kind of guidance of it and what it was.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I suppose ownership is the right word. I feel the greatest sense of ownership over. Hang on, have we gone 3-2-1 or are we going 1-2-3?
I didn't give you that stipulation, so you can decide.
Okay, well, let's...
Although Harvester has to be one, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's true, I suppose. And then actually, I mean, I suppose this ties in nicely, doesn't it? My book is one of the things I'm proudest of. When that arrived, Andy Gladwin arranged for a copy to be sent to me when they first arrived at the
UK. He didn't sell it to you, he actually sent it to you.
Yeah, I know, I couldn't believe it.
He doesn't normally do that.
Because I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll get a slight discount.
Yeah, 10% but, standard. Yeah.
But no, he sent me a copy of my own book for free.
Wow.
I was absolutely overjoyed. In fact, perhaps that should be the thing I'm proudest of.
You got a free book out of Gladwin.
But no, when it arrived and I unwrapped it, which was, it was kind of a lovely experience, and I held it in my hands, I feel like it's a much better book now than it was when I first released it. And because I feel like I'm a better writer now than I was,
right,
you know, sort of 12 years ago, whenever it was when I wrote it. And so, yeah, I kind of held it in my hands and I flicked through the pages and I thought, my goodness, I have a real sense of, I've written this thing. Wow. I made this. Yeah. And so that was a lovely feeling.
We're so... over time, Mr. Long, but we always end the show on 4 quick-fire questions. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Favourite pizza topping?
The chorizo.
Favourite movie?
I get mocked for saying this, but Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl.
Favourite person or people that make music?
That's difficult, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I've been listening to a lot of Bon Iver again recently, B-O-N... /IVER, and really getting back into them again, and they think they're wonderful. So I'll say Bon Iver.
Okay. And finally, who would you rather fight, one massive Andy or 100 tiny Joshes?
Yes, this question comes up, doesn't it, on your show? I've thought about this a little bit. My fighting strategy is to run and hide. I think that's what I have most success at in a fight. And I just think that strategy couldn't work against... How many tiny Joshes?
100.
100 tiny Joshes. I don't think it would work very well. And plus, I think you'd just be like finding them in your laundry like weeks later, after you thought the fight was over. And so, whereas one massive Andy, just in my head, also in my head, I know this is quick fire, but in my head, when Andy becomes bigger and becomes massive, he also becomes really quite stupid and slow and bumbling. And so I think whether this is actually true, we'd have to wait and see when the fight comes. But I think I could outwit him. I think I could run away. I think I could hide in a place that he just, you know, oh, where's he gone? You know, I think I could reach that point with giant and in my head, kind of very slow and stupid Andy.
Okay. I think that's in several episodes of this show, I think that's the most thought anyone's put into that final question. So I appreciate the time that you've spent dedicated to thinking about the 100 tiny whoever question.
Yeah, who do I invoice for that? I'll invoice Andy for that.
Right? Yeah, invoice Andy. Yeah, he'll probably pay you in books.
Great. That I've written.
Of course, yes. Stephen Long, thank you so much for giving me your time this evening. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to seeing you at the session.
Thank you for having me. It's been a delight.